Merry Christmas to all the listeners and to our guest tonight, Ethan Sherwood Strauss. Ethan, what's up?
Nothing much. I'm just trying to understand what we saw today. It was very disjointed. It wasn't like any of the hype about what it would be.
Yeah, I guess. But if we really stop to think about it a little deeper, I tweeted this at the beginning of the game that this is not at all what it's going to be in June, whether it's just because the Warriors didn't necessarily deploy the optimal lineup at the start, but more I think just from the Cavs side with Kyrie still being on the minutes limit and working his way back. And I think we saw that with, you know, how he played. He was able to get good shots and then just couldn't hit them.
Yeah, he looked a lot better than the production. He had some of those ooh and ah plays that he can produce when he's really got it in the gear, but he did miss some outside shots he probably usually drains, and there were, even though you had that brilliant finish, lefty finish on Draymond towards the end, a lot of those finishes at the rim weren't on point. So he wasn't all the way there.
Yeah, I will say, though, I mean, that's probably the biggest takeaway of this game for me, having not seen Irving in the two games that he's been back yet, was just that, I mean, yeah, he wasn't all the way there. He missed some shots that he might normally make when he's fully back into it, but I didn't see anything troubling from him to indicate that he's not going to get right back to where he was last year, ultimately. Did you?
Yeah, that's a good takeaway. I wasn't necessarily looking for that because I'm sort of seeing things, I guess, through a Warriors gaze, if you will, where that's the gamer I have to write, so I'm not necessarily charting the progress of what he looked like against, say, Philadelphia versus this, but he did look good physically, and that's a good thing for the league and certainly a good thing for the Cavs. I did have a bigger takeaway from this game, though, and maybe it's reading too much into it. I don't know. But my takeaway was I was more concerned about how the Cavs would stack up than I was going in, just because of how awful Kevin Love looked in the small ball downsizing that both teams went through at the end.
Yeah, and Curry, who was had kind of throttled it back most of the game, maybe that was due to that calf, we'll talk about that, but he had a couple of layups late where he basically just went in and finger rolled with absolutely zero resistance when Love was the center, and you know, it was Love and LeBron. They tried to really downsize. Golden State went to the Diet Coke of death lineups with Livingston instead of Barnes. I'm an Austin Powers fan. I'm always going to enjoy that. And we both tweeted almost simultaneously that Love was just utterly non-existent on those plays.
And not only that, but he's just so plodding in a transition game. And you have situations where I remember on one late possession, he didn't get a foul call he thought he should get at the rim, and then he kind of complained. And then Draymond just beat him back down the floor, I think, for a pass from Iguodala for a dunk. And there was just no excuse for that in that situation. I don't understand, given his placement on the floor and how the play ended, exactly how that unfolded. But it looks like they can't use that guy in that situation, and that'd be a big problem if this is to be the finals matchup for them.
Well, the one thing I would disagree with is that I think that the Warriors may potentially have big problems guarding the Cavs on the other
end. Well, really guarding one guy in particular.
Well, yeah, guarding LeBron with Love spaced out to the three-point line. And we saw there's only one play really where it happened and LeBron just happened to miss the layup, but even when Andre, who does a great job usually of avoiding getting back down, I mean, he almost just like avoids getting back down too fast, and so the help can get there. But with Love as the center instead of someone like Thompson or Mozgov, they really just weren't able to bring help at all. So I do think that Cleveland is going to be able to score on the Warriors much better than they have in the finals and then in this game, once they get all their guys healthy. And they should have scored much better in this game than they did. They just couldn't hit a shot.
Yeah, that was certainly a factor to it. And you saw the unguardability of LeBron in that great sequence he had that included, I think, that block on Klay Thompson was part of that sequence. And it kind of ended when he missed those two free throws, but that was still a high-quality does high-quality foul even make sense as a sentence? But he earned that trip to the foul line, I should say, because he was dominating in that stretch. And it's so hard against him because teams that want to go bigger than the Warriors, they can't necessarily generate the speed and the efficiency with which to bully like he can. And it's just that can be really effective against a small Warriors lineup. If you have a guy who can dribble himself into a quick post up, or just beat people back down the floor and like Blake Griffin does, just get a quick seal, that can be really effective against a death-ish lineup.
I agree with you. Yeah, was for Cleveland's perspective, I mean, is there anything else that you could take out of this, you know, from a strategic standpoint? Like, what do you think worked well for them? What do you think didn't work well?
That's a great question. I thought it was interesting the way they tried weird stuff on Curry. I thought that was interesting. Where they and Curry mentioned this after the game. I think you were there for that. Where at one point they double teamed him. I think it was in the first quarter. Was the first time where what will often happen, and this is something that you lament with Bogut, when the big man takes a while to get back down the court as Bogut often does, then Curry will
on offense.
Yeah. On offense, I mean, yes. Curry will often be double teamed by the center, and until Bogut gets back into the play, right? And you know, actually, and I would say this. This might be too harsh a comment, but I will say this: if your team's not doing that, your team's probably not well coached. If they're not doing that, because that's just something you should do on the margins. Well, what the Cavs did is they started with that, and then on a play, there wasn't even a screen for Curry, and they just stuck with it. I think with Kevin Love also helping to double Curry, which just seeds an automatic 4-on-3 situation. It's not usually you'll see that double team happen on a trapping situation. So that was weird, and then you kind of saw it again at the end of a quarter where LeBron just ran over, I think, with 8 or 9 seconds to just double Curry, and it just Andre could have shot a corner three, but he didn't, and they kind of botched it. And so I thought they were being a little more creative and just throwing weird looks at Curry, and I do think that, while not sustainable, it was something that worked in their favor.
Yeah, and part of that, I mean, it was hard to tell where Kevin Love's kind of weird pick-and-roll defense started and
yeah.
A discernible strategy
this is funny. Started. Like maybe Kevin Love was just doing things that made no sense, and I'm interpreting it as creativity.
Because they started the game with Love and Mozgov, as they often do, and then Curry on those pick-and-rolls. I mean, Love would, already double-team a little bit when Draymond would set the screen, but then he just would stay there even after Steph made the pass. Like, he was – or, you know, he would double team and the guard would, you know, didn't get screened off and he would still be there. And Love would then, you know, wouldn't try to get back to Draymond. He would just stay there with Curry. And that, you know, he did not execute very well. I mean, I was tweeting at the beginning of the game that, you know, it looked like he was going to be a major defensive problem. And he had a couple of decent plays where he moved his feet, but overall did not look good. And eventually the Cavs went to a strategy where and the Cavs also, they started J.R. Smith. They didn't start Shumpert. They're going to start Shumpert in the finals for sure. You know, Kyrie's going to play more than like 25 minutes or whatever. So they actually went to Shumpert guarding Draymond Green for large stretches of the game so they could switch the pick and roll in Curry. I thought that was another interesting wrinkle they threw out there.
I thought that was smart. I think that's a good idea. And this is also a hard game, though, to assess in terms of what worked and what didn't. You talk about how it's not going to look anything like the finals, because I felt an underrated aspect of it is Curry doesn't look right out there. I look, this is the obvious stupid caveat of I'm not a doctor, but it seems like it would be a good idea to maybe get him a game off or two in the future.
Well, I was a little concerned when I heard it was a calf injury. That's the first we've heard of, like, him having any trouble with his calf, right?
Yeah. I mean, obviously there's the history of right ankle injuries, but not a history of calf injuries.
Yeah, and when he came back in after that, he definitely looked like he was just playing in, you know, second gear out of five for most of the game. And he can still be pretty effective that way just because of the threat that he presents.
Yeah, I mean, you can rob a bank with a candy bar. I don't know why I just like turned into Dan Rather. Like you can, you know, you can't swindle an elephant out of two quarters or just something that makes no sense. But yeah, you can, the threat accomplishes a lot. It accomplishes a lot. And even if he's not going at full speed and if Kevin Love isn't really giving any rim protection, he can essentially waddle his way into a layup.
And it was encouraging that Curry was able to go hard right at the end of the game when he blew by. He blew by LeBron like he was just standing in the mud
at one point.
On one play when he got switched onto him. And then he also blew by Delly in an ISO at the top of the key to really, you know, kind of salt the game away. So it was good to see that. I mean, it may have been that, you know, he's just kind of felt some pain there and just didn't really want to push it too hard throughout most of the game and then just went.
What concerned me was it wasn't so much his return, but it was the nature of the injury itself, where we've already heard that in Wednesday's game against Utah, he bumped into Rodney Hood, and it was a bruise, he said. And then we see an injury that's seemingly connected to a bruise, where I remember the play was early in the first quarter. It was a steal, possibly. Maybe it was a steal or a quick rebound. And Draymond had the ball, got the ball, and he just started pushing the break, and Steph was in good position to run with him, and he just pulled up. He just stopped right there. And that's probably my guess as far as when it happened. And you'd have to think it'd be pretty painful knowing Steph Curry and seeing Steph Curry to not want to be part of a possible getting a transition three situation and just completely giving up on the possession like he did. And so I think that's kind of concerning. Obviously, when the team's asked about it, they say it's fine. Steph says, I'm fine. Teams are pretty weird about injuries and often try to put on a front.
Well, especially in the case of him, where the effect that he provides is such a deterrent that you don't want to provide any idea that he's not Steph Curry, you know. But calf injuries are things that are very easy to re-injure. They can very much linger. So it is going to be something to monitor. I mean, we'll see how he looks. They don't play again until Monday now. Mm-hmm. Against the Kings, so we'll see maybe how he looks.
It's always concerning where you have an injury to a body part and then a subsequent injury to that same body part. I'm not criticizing the training staff because there are so many factors to weigh and there's still so much I don't even know about whatever this thing is, but I do wonder. I have no reason to doubt the people on this training staff, but I think it might be a learning year for them, where they're still figuring out how to get everything done.
Yeah, because they have a new staff now with Johan being in Atlanta now. Did not have his contract renewed.
Yeah. The trainer didn't have his contract renewed, and then the strength and conditioning guys, KK Lyles and Mike Roncarati, I'm probably butchering that, and I'm sorry to you, Mike. They moved on, and so the Warriors, they got people from Australia who were into sports science, and they combined them with somebody who was on last year's training staff, Drew Yoder. I don't know how well they know each other and if they have a dynamic that works for them yet. So that's really inside baseball without a whole lot of information right there, and I'm sorry about that. But I do think that's a slight concern. Whether the training staff is completely on point. I think they'll probably get better as they go forward because I've only heard good things about them, but I do wonder about their ability off the bat to be good at this.
I love the matchup between these two teams, and because there are just so many individual matchups and who's guarding who and who's going to be starting, like all of that seems like hypercritical with these teams. And, you know, for example, Shumpert is guarding Draymond. You know, Draymond actually has become a very effective player in the post this year, I think. And then James, in that alignment, was forced to guard Klay Thompson. And, you know, that's not something that James is going to want to do. I mean, he had that one spectacular block where he chased him down, but Klay was able to blow by him initially. And you know, James doesn't want to chase Klay around screens you know, stick to him at the three-point line either. That's an imperfect solution.
Yeah, it'll be shades of the Miami Heat death lineup against the Pacers when you'd have James at center almost, and you would have Ray Allen being guarded by David West. Now, obviously, James is more mobile than David West is, but he's not necessarily somebody who's used to navigating those floppy screens and those types of screens on a shooter. And it's hard. It's kind of hard when you're bulky like that. You want somebody who's got the agility to kind of get through spaces like a KCP if you're going to have that sort of assignment.
Well, and I think that ultimately it worked okay in a regular season game with Walton as the coach, But that's something that just ultimately is going to get exploited. You know, whether it's Draymond just posting up Shumpert. I mean, not every time, but on occasion, Clay. Whether they just find someone else to put in, you know, whoever Love is guarding, put him in a pick and roll. I think there's always going to be a counter there, and I think that I trust the staff to do that pretty well. And I think ultimately Cleveland, their best option is just going to be to try to outscore the Warriors, which seems crazy, but they actually kind of have the personnel to do it if they're all healthy, because I think just Kyrie and Love and then LeBron just having to save his energy for offense, that's three guys where you're just not going to be able to defend at an absolute elite level. So I ultimately think that if these teams do match up in the finals, it's going to be a far different tenor than it has been in, you know, these last seven matchups that they
have. I think so. This is a total digression, but when you mentioned Draymond and his improved ability on the post, I'm thinking, has there ever been a player in NBA history who has been able to do more things besides just hit an off the dribble shot?
Yeah, I mean, that's really the one thing that he can't. Although he's still, part of the way they're defending him, he still just does not want to take the open three like that.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the next step for him, is actually, if he's open for three, just taking it every single time until they just stop guarding him. I mean, because, it was that same confrontation that we saw in the finals many a time where they were just sticking to everybody else. It would be a two-on-one, and Draymond would just go in at the rim. He succeeded more often in this game than he did in those first few games of the finals when he had that two-on-one at the rim. But I think ultimately if he can shoot that shot, it'll be more helpful for them.
Yeah, and he and also Andre Iguodala both have that, where sometimes the ball will swing to them and they will be open for three, and then there will be a pump fake that doesn't need to really be there. So they both have that where they run hot and cold as far as the confidence and the shooting from outside.
Yeah, and they're two unselfish guys too, where I think they just sort of have this internal gauge of, all right, how often am I shooting? How often is everyone else shooting? You know, maybe I shouldn't take this one, you know, even if he is being left open every time. What did you think of how LeBron played today?
Whew, that's a good question. I mean, he didn't have a good game. I'd say that much. But the question of, did he have a bad game?
I mean, I thought he had the exact same game that he had in most of those games in the finals, except, you know, didn't play quite as many minutes and, you know, it wasn't quite as high of stakes.
Yeah. I think it was a similar kind of game where the outside shot wasn't quite there yet again. And there was that brilliant stretch in the fourth, and that sort of can cloud your memory of how.
But you're talking about when he had those two dunks?
Yeah, the two dunks.
Yeah, I thought those were both kind of just blown coverages.
Well, yeah, Andre gambled for the steal, but still, it was good that he was.
And then the next time, Draymond just went under and got held by Dellavedova, whoever was setting that screen, and because that's what the Warriors were doing on a lot of those pick and rolls, they just went so far under. I mean, like Andre Iguodala, like, might have been in Fremont one time when they were on the south end of the stadium going under one of those pick and rolls. That's the funniest thing I'll ever say in this podcast.
No, that was the funniest thing you'll ever say. that instant self-deprecating repudiation of what you had just said. That was the best. That was the best right there.
I think it's a problem. Like, the LeBron who could hit a jump shot, these tactics wouldn't be working on him. You know, he should not, you know, when he can only shoot within 5 feet, it really just limits what he's able to do so much.
Yeah, I don't think he had a very good game, and I don't exactly know why his jump shot has waned as he's gotten a little bit older. I'm not sure. Maybe it has to do with the role. It wasn't a particularly impressive performance, but just like Steph Curry, where there's a threat presented, LeBron has this shadow influence of his versatility that has a dramatic impact on the game.
Yeah, I think that's probably true, and you're always worried about him kind of backing down, and you just cannot get a smaller defender on him a lot of times. So that's definitely a concern, and there's still, you know, he still has that kind of athletic, you know, at least for probably another couple of years when you, you know, he can get guys from behind and stuff. You're always know where LeBron is on the court on both ends. Like, you can tell that guys are always aware of him. After this game, are you more or less confident about Cleveland's ability to potentially defeat the Warriors in a finals matchup?
This is interesting because I feel like you're more confident and I'm less confident.
They shot 12 out of 37 on uncontested shots. They got probably 10 wide open threes that they just ganked.
Yeah, that's true. And there's an element of randomness and just basic randomness and luck that plays into the offensive result that they got today. At the same time, I think their opponent also missed some outside shots. At the same time, just as far as the matchup, and it's just whatever you take away from it. Well, you can take away from when they went small ball versus small ball, you can take away that LeBron had opportunities to score, or you can take away that Kevin Love looked awful. And for some reason, just Love's inability to compete on that sort of terrain gave me less confidence in Cleveland's abilities going forward. And that's a very subjective takeaway, but that's the takeaway. It's just a subjective, mushy, less confidence after seeing that.
Yeah, I certainly understand that viewpoint. Oh, would you say
and what plays into it too is the starting of Brandon Rush. I know we're talking about the Kyrie.
Yeah. Well, that was going to be my next question, actually, is who was further from full strength in this game, the Warriors or the Cavs?
I would say for once it was the Warriors, for once, where it's been the Cavs in the past. And that's because Curry did not look like himself for, I'd say, the entirety of the game, not really looking to score, not really looking to shoot.
Yeah, and the two big bench lineup, which continues to just get destroyed at all times. That's
the
not
gift as soon of as, points to the other team.
Yeah, it's just as like soon as Harrison
an hourglass get tipped over and just sand pouring out is
and just wondering how long Luke Walton is going to wait before he like turns the hourglass back over again.
That's exactly what it is.
It's really you can understand a little bit more this time because maybe they're like, all right, you know, they have Love at power forward or whatever, but it's just why don't they just try and see whether the other team is just going to kill them with their second big in that lineup instead of just going to the two bigs because they have two bigs and, oh, we're going to be too small. Like, it's been demonstrated that no matter what the other team's lineup is, the two bigs doesn't work. So at least try small and see whether your hunch that it's just not going to work, they're too big for us, actually plays out into losing points or not. My suspicion is the extra shooting and spacing will more than make up for the fact that they're bigger, or at least stanch the bleeding slightly more than has, but this is all maybe apropos of nothing as it ultimately turns out because Harrison will just be the backup four.
There's no cheering in the press box. That's a taboo, but something that I enjoyed tonight was your reaction to, I believe, the final time that Rush was subbed out for McAdoo.
Yeah, because they started it the way I always wanted them to start with Andre at the four and Rush at the three. And then they brought Love back in, and they immediately went away from it. Michael McAdoo
sounded like a samurai in a movie who has been stabbed in the stomach in his death scene.
All right, well, I think that's far enough away from cheering that I wasn't.
You're just like, what? Just the sound of just guttural frustration.
And we weren't even sitting next to each other either. That's like the funniest part.
No. I just looked down the road. Just what was that noise? What animal just died? And no, it was. It was a reaction to that bad two big substitution, and I think they do that for the most part because they've got too many backup bigs, and they're trying to get as many people involved as possible, and it sometimes eats into what's the most effective basketball decision. And so because of that, and because that's another perspective you can take away if you want to be Cavs positive about it. You can take away, we missed a bunch of open shots. That's what David Blatt actually said after the game, and he seemed to be really happy with his team's performance. But what you can also take away is that the Warriors didn't even give this their best shot. They said, we're just going to start Brandon Rush because we feel like it. And
who did okay, in fairness.
Defensively, he competed a lot.
He was also he was also really nervous offensively, like you could tell. And then when he got stripped by LeBron early on, you're like, oh, man, like he's just like – And then I think someone, like, told him, like, in the start of the second half, like, hey, man, like, just play your game. Like, go ahead and shoot. And then he was, like, really aggressive shooting. And he didn't make any of them either. So he sort of, like,
speaking of, that's actually one of my favorite things about the NBA is just watching players who might be nervous and just how they react. And I just wonder just the amount of adrenaline flowing through Ian Clark's veins. Adrenaline flows through veins, yes? I mean, this is why I shouldn't be commenting on medical matters like I was earlier.
No, I mean, yeah.
Yeah, that's what happens. Yes, that's how it happens.
Is the endocrine system? Yeah, I think it ultimately gets deposited into the bloodstream.
The knee bones connected to the foot bone and so forth. Anyway, he just the amount of adrenaline that must have been just pulsating through him as he stole the ball from LeBron and then was just trying to sneak it past him in that transition play for what would have been the play of his life. If he could have gotten the layup down, that is real drama. Not watching a guy like Steph Curry.
Well, and the other thing is he got elbowed on that play by LeBron too. There was no call. Everyone kind of stopped because they thought that was going to be a call. And then when, like, much later on, when LeBron was like, when Ian was like coming back, or Ian was leaving the game, and LeBron was coming back in later on, and Ian like had something to say to him about that play. I would imagine like. You know, 5 minutes later. So I know you got to go. It's pretty late here.
I can go. I can go for a while. Unless you're trying to, I mean, you could be just using that as a device to try to end this. I don't know. But I'm saying I
could be. Well, I want to stick to my promises. I said like a half hour.
You know.
We do have to talk about the intentional fouling.
Oh, yes. I had blocked that part out.
Oh, yeah. It really, so for if you didn't see the game, basically, the Cavs are shooting free throws late when they're down, you know, four or five. And Blatt instructed that actually Luke Walton took a timeout in between LeBron free throws, kind of to ice him, which is always a good strategy because you make more of your second free throw than you do your first, because you kind of have a practice. So that was a good strategy to call that timeout. But then in the timeout, Blatt told Delly, foul Andre Iguodala really hard while you are quote unquote going for the rebound. And, you know, we'll put Andre on the line immediately since we're down. And it worked. And then they did the same thing with Draymond the next time down. Draymond, I think, made two. And then they finally fouled Iguodala again. And they ended up making, like, four out of six or something. But it was just, I thought, an abhorrent tactic just for, like, the spirit of the game. And, you know, just yet another, like, lawyer-like loophole in the rule. It's basically like courtroom basketball at this point.
Courtroom basketball. You know what I found was funny about it is I don't think Draymond Green thought that way about it. When he was asked about it, it seemed like he had respect for the tactic, just as somebody who's willing to do anything to win, that he didn't have a real issue with it. And the big issue I have is with the NBA on this. I don't have an issue with what the Cavs did because
no, of course not. Yeah. Nothing that you're doing within the rules to try and win. It's the same reason I have a problem with guys who try to take charges. Like that's, you know, it's the way that it's officiated and the way that the NBA needs to deal with it. And it's so easy because all you have to do is just have like the same rule as FIBA or the same rule as college where it's just an intentional foul.
Mm. Sorry, I was drinking water as you were ending that. It was very professional of me.
All right, well, why don't you finish drinking water, and we'll play this little clip here on what Andrew Bogut had to say when I asked him what he thought of the intentional over-the-back fouls on the offensive rebounds.
Okay.
What did you think of the strategy with Dellavedova doing the intentional fouls on the free throw offensive rebound late? Is that a surprise to you? Like, do you think that's something that should be part of the game late, even under 2 minutes?
I mean, it is a comical. I think it's excellent times to go to the free throw line and you got to knock them down. So, you know, if you can make one for two in those points, I think it's one of the best teams per, you know, points per possession in the league. So you just got to go one for two. But it's an interesting one. You know, more and more teams are starting to do it. We saw, I think JJ Redick did it against the Pistons. It's interesting that when the ball goes in the basket on a free throw, they can still call a foul. So I don't know what the league's going to do with that, but it can make a game go, you know, a long, long time when teams are trying to do that.
Andrew, was that more like an AFL specky? Someone's jump over the back room like a tackle?
Yeah, I mean, he's done a good job with it, but it's a strategy that they thought would work. It worked once with Andre, but then he knocked him down, and Draymond knocked him down. So it's what teams are starting to go to now to maybe give themselves an extra position because obviously it doesn't take time off the clock. So if you can get one miss and come down here to three, you've made up some ground. So probably see more and more teams doing it.
Yeah, so I agree with Andrew, especially because they gave him the foul on a made free throw.
It's just insane. Like, how can that be the rule?
Like, just like, that's when just, like, let it go or something. But on the other hand, maybe it's not quite as much of a disaster because generally, if you're ahead in a game, you're not going to be fouling. So that at least helps a little bit, you know, and it's in the last 2 minutes, so you can't foul off the ball. That's what all this is supposed to get around. But, I mean, Lord, does the NBA just need to take care of this problem. There's such an easy solution, you know, the one employed by literally every other basketball league on the planet.
Yeah, that's something you should keep saying because I think a lot of people don't know that when they...
No, they don't, like, and I don't know why. I mean, you never seen a high school game. You never seen a college game.
Yeah, well, there's this assumption that you should just make your free throws and this is how it always is and it's how it's always going to be. And that kind of assumption just presupposes that it's the same way everywhere, and it's not. Actually, everywhere else... they do the logical thing, and they don't reward this use of the loophole that creates a really boring game. And it's frustrating that the NBA, when confronted with this issue, and they have been for years, and people have been talking about it for years, tried to almost quarantine the problem or frame it as something that was quarantined, that it was just one guy or one or two guys, as though this couldn't become an approach that was broadly more applied. And, of course, we've seen that since. And now, so that argument that they've used to defend keeping the status quo on this has completely fallen apart. So I'm interested to see what the pivot might be, or maybe they'll just do the obvious thing and fix it.
Yeah, Jay Adande actually, in an interview with Commissioner Silver, probably the only watchable part of that Lakers-Clippers game, asked him about that. And the commissioner said, yeah, we're aware that there are now have been more intentional fouls this year than there were all last year. Already, which and Kevin Pelton has been doing great work on this. It's a subject near and dear to his heart, as it is to mine, as well. All right. So, anything else that you wanted to talk about here from this game before we go? Well, actually, since I have you on, do you think that the Warriors are going to set the all-time wins record?
I was asked that by an Israeli TV station. I don't know. I was at. They asked me. Who knows why, and, you know, to do a little interview. And so I talked to them, and they asked me this question, and nobody had asked me it before. And just off the top of my head, gut reaction, at this point, they've only lost one game. Yeah, I kind of think they're going to do it. But, hey, maybe.
I mean, all they have to do is play as well as they played last year from now on,
yeah,
basically.
Yeah, I mean, hey, but maybe the looming thing is whatever's going on.
Yeah, the Curry thing, yeah.
So... gun to my head, that's what I'm guessing. What about you?
Oh, gosh. You know, that Bulls team, the 96 Bulls, was 41-3 at the All-Star, or not at the break, but basically halfway through. And then they lost two in a row to go to 41-5. If they can make it halfway through the year with two or three losses, then I will start thinking about it pretty seriously. And, yeah, they still have to avoid injury. Obviously, and their schedule coming up is not really that hard either. You know, I don't think they have a game really that you would characterize as, you know, even a tough one until maybe the Spurs game on the 25th. I mean, they're probably their hardest game is maybe like Houston on the road or Charlotte at home over their next 12, and that'll get them to the halfway mark. So if they're 41-3 or better at the halfway mark, then I'm going to start really thinking about it. And I think they can get there. I would give them, at this point, probably, you know, a 40% chance of getting there.
Yeah.
And most of that 40% is based on the fact that I think they could have more injuries. Most of that 60% that they don't get.
Yeah, more injuries, and maybe they don't go for it. Maybe I'm already flip-flopping and waffling, but...
I think they'll go for it. I think these are the kind of guys, you know, especially with Kerr. He was on a team that went for it. I think these guys have the egos, all this crap about how it was such luck. I think they are going to do it. But you know more people than I do.
But just the drain in pursuit of the streak that they might have suffered. I mean, Curry in his last five games is shooting, what, 28% from three? In his last five.
And the biggest thing is he's just not getting nearly as many attempts as he was.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he was shooting like you know, 12, 13 attempts a game from three, and now he's getting, you know, five, six. I mean, he's getting like two made threes in all these games. I mean, I think it's more even the volume than it is the percentage.
I would agree. And through, I think until maybe the third quarter, he was sitting on one legit three-point attempt. He had a buzzer heave that counts as a three-point attempt. And that's another thing. I don't want those counted as three-point attempts. That's another reform as I'm dictator of the NBA and I'm just cleaning up the very niche topics that are on the fringes of the game. But, yeah, he's not really seeking it out. And it seems to be more physical than it is an approach, I believe. And so is that related to how much they push themselves in pursuit of the streak? I don't know. But I wonder if the lesson of whatever that took out of them will be applied more broadly to the season. And when you asked me what other thing to talk about, I just want to apologize to any sneakerheads I might have offended in my game column for this game, because I probably got a bunch of things wrong. So that's the main thing. I only had to just go on what people told me as far as what Draymond was wearing, because I think I built some of what I was talking about, because I find this stuff sort of interesting, how Draymond wears the LeBron team sneaker, and he just likes that shoe a lot, and he gets along with LeBron. They have a relationship. They had some sort of college football.
Yeah, it seemed very like kumbaya, this game, other than Ian Clark and LeBron. That was about it.
Indeed. You know, and Draymond famously now, I mean, a week ago or whatever, said...
Yeah, the wine thing?
I'm saying that he said when he was angry at O.J. Mayo that he'd never let a man touch my head, and there's a photo of LeBron getting in there. Had palm on the noggin. So, you know, that's the sort of status that that LeBron has. He's allowed to touch Draymond Green's head. So, you know, they're quite friendly, but at the same time there's just this taboo of you're guarding a guy, you're competing against a guy, and if you're wearing his shoe, he's essentially your dad. And so it was interesting to see the way he had to handle that, where he started out in another shoe. And I might have gotten the name of the shoe wrong because I can't actually see from where we are in the media section what the shoes are. And then at halftime, he switched to the LeBron shoe. I think A, because he was already playing well, so he wasn't embarrassing himself while wearing LeBron shoes. And B, it was just more comfortable. So I think I got various details wrong because I am not a sneakerhead. I'm interested in that culture in part because there is a committed community of people who are obsessive and know things I don't know.
All right. Well, I can assure you that I would get even further details wrong, so I'm not really in position to comment on this further. That's an aspect that I really now socks. Of course, I know.
Yeah.
I know everything.
I mean, you're the sock man. You were talking up your sock game pregame when we were schmoozing. You know.
One more thing I will say. You know, there's been this edict. Or I shouldn't say edict, but an understanding around the team that Steph was kind of doing too much. Draymond pointed to that again after the game. And maybe, you know, what part of his struggles is just that he's still trying to get more guys involved. And to that end, I mean, Steph had 71 touches in this game and Draymond had 80 touches.
Yeah.
So that's like a pretty remarkable, that when Steph is the point guard and, you know, the best player in the game, at least so far this season, and Draymond actually had more touches than he did. And it just, and maybe that was just the calf as well, where Steph was just not being that aggressive running pick and rolls. And you know, that could be, I do think that the Warriors sort of, all right, we're going to move the ball, blah, blah, like beautiful game, all these assists, you know, run stuff with Steph off the ball. That has worked great most of the time, but in the two times that they struggled against Cleveland and against Memphis to score, I felt like they just needed to just go back to the bread and butter with the ball in Steph's hands a little bit more, because whenever they actually run a pick and roll with him, they almost invariably create something good. And the off the ball stuff against real good defense for him doesn't work quite as well, because they're just going to hold him.
Yeah, they've got that Spurs sort of downside of the broader good thing, which is, when Jamal Crawford is guarding Kawhi Leonard, the Spurs aren't oriented in such a way, or at least weren't.
Now they are.
Yeah, now they are. Now they're more deliberate with it. But in that,
although they still are second, I think, in like percentage of assisted baskets this year.
Yeah. But you know, in that playoff series, that they're not exactly geared to take advantage of that. And the Warriors have a little bit of that too, where Kerr's philosophy is it all comes out in the wash, and if you've got some sort of mismatch, just run your offense, and the defense will be destabilized from that. But sometimes it just makes more sense to play selfish basketball. Sometimes it makes more sense to go OKC Thunder.
Yeah, one thing was interesting. We didn't see, I don't think, a single time where a big switched onto Curry the whole game.
Yeah, they were so much more oriented to go the trapping route as opposed to the switched route. And maybe if Steph had been more aggressive, we would have seen the switch as a counter. But it never got to that point.
All right, man. So you wrote your gamer about Draymond and how well he played, obviously. It's nice to see him getting a few 20-point performances here that should help solidify him for the points-only crowd for the All-Star game. Anything else you've written lately you want to talk about?
I've written a few articles.
Oh, the Barbosa piece.
Oh, yeah. Right, yeah.
Talk about that.
I wrote a mushy, subjective, totally not grounded in hard basketball.
And therefore anathema to this podcast.
Anathema. A fluff piece. The Andrew Barbosa fluff piece. I just found him really interesting to talk to.
I really like that article. I do have a heart, contrary to what some say.
Well, I appreciate that. I enjoyed talking to him, and I enjoyed just the concept of how one can interact with people when there's a bit of a language barrier, and how that almost gives you wiggle room in conversations, and the way Barbosa can razz his teammates and say things that are cruel and maybe hurtful if somebody else says them, but because his accent is adorable, it's just fine, and it helps create chemistry. So I enjoyed that and how that worked.
All right. So thanks, Ethan, for coming on. Next segment is going to be Dan Feldman talking about the rest of the games after this commercial break. All right, to go through the remainder of the Christmas games and do a little news with us, friend of the program and far too infrequent guest, Dan Feldman. What's up, man?
Hey, how's it going?
Quite well. Merry Christmas. I can still say that being on the West Coast with it being 11 o'clock. It's appropriate for me to do so. What'd you do today?
Oh, watched a little basketball and fulfilled the great Jewish tradition of eating Chinese food. How about you?
Yeah, I did not eat Chinese food, unfortunately, but went to Warriors Cavs and watched a ton of basketball myself. We celebrated last night, actually, since I told everyone that I had to work.
Nice.
So let's do a little news first. One piece of news from Woj's podcast, he reported that the Bulls are trying to get a wing by moving either Gibson or Noah. Do you think, A, that is advisable, and B, are there any potential targets that would really help them with those guys?
Yeah, I think it makes some sense, and you could probably throw Pau Gasol into there as far as the big that makes sense to move. I mean, they went into last season with four quality bigs, and it seemed like one too many, and since then you add Bobby Portis, it's tough to get all those guys minutes. They're wedging Mirotić in at the three, and that's not really working. You know, I think it makes sense to try and get a wing. I don't have a target in mind, but I definitely think they should be open, especially Noah and Gasol, who are going to be free agents next year, trading Gibson, who's under contract another year or two. I think it's only one more, is a little trickier.
Yeah, well, I think, trading away Gibson is dangerous because Gasol and Noah could both be free agents. They could lose both of those guys.
You know what's scarier? What if they one or both come back? They're much older. What if they fall off?
Yeah, that's a point, too. And those guys, obviously, I mean, maybe Gasol would be a short enough contract that you wouldn't worry about it. Although, you know, I get the impression that he's not, like, unbelievably happy there. But, you know, I mean, nothing that I've heard specifically, but I just, you know, it doesn't seem like he's totally in on what they're doing. You know, he made the comment about wanting more post-ups earlier in the year. I mean, I guess part of the problem, I mean, number one is that there aren't that many teams that are sellers right now, and because there aren't that many teams that are out of it. And number two is there just aren't as many wings as there are bigs in the league right now. So I can't really think of a team that is going to be improved by trading away a wing for a Gibson or a Noah at this point.
You know, one thing that was out there, and I really don't think this makes much sense for the Timberwolves, but there was a report that the Timberwolves have some interest in Noah, and you know, there was a previous report that Kevin Martin's on the block. You know, I don't know if that's outlandish. I don't think that works straight up with the cap. I think Minnesota would have to send out a little more salary. But a deal based around that, I think that could be a starting point.
Oof. You would do that if you were the Bulls?
I mean, I
don't see why either team would do it, frankly.
I wouldn't do it if I were Minnesota, because if I like Noah and I want Noah, I'd just go after him in free agency. There's no point of giving up an asset for him now. If I'm the Bulls, maybe. I guess I'd have to think long and hard about what my plans are for him next summer, though. You know, if I'm not going to make Noah an offer that's what it's going to take to keep him, if I just think his body's breaking down and they should have more info on that than I do, you know, I might consider that if I really think Martin is that missing wing piece and can help you hold it together until Mike Dunleavy gets healthy.
Yeah, there's no reason to think that. I mean, like, Martin is basically Doug McDermott, except probably not even as good anymore, frankly. I mean, at least McDermott now has gotten to the point where he can execute the system defensively. Martin is way too skinny. You can't play Martin and McDermott together because you'll never be able to guard anyone. So that just means you're going to play Martin over McDermott, which I'm not really sure why you would do that and why you'd give it up an asset to get a guy like that. And then for the Wolves, what do you want with Noah? When you have Karl Anthony Towns on your team, are you going to play those guys together? That would be terrible. Well, Towns is a center. I mean, I wouldn't put it past them. Like, they probably would do that because they're not exactly huge fans of playing guys in the right positions. But Towns is a center, and he's played incredibly well almost entirely as a center so far this year. Like, no reason to mess that up, in my opinion. Let's move on to kind of wrapped up in this is the fact that Noah is out at least 2 weeks with a sprained shoulder. Possibly as much as four. We'll see. He's supposed to be reevaluated in 2 weeks. But at least, you know, they avoided any further damage where he's going to require surgery or anything. That's encouraging. Here's another trade one for you. David Lee is available in trade talks.
Yeah, I can't believe the Celtics would give up on him already after after he was their prized trade acquisition of the offseason. I mean,
well, you know, and people were saying, oh, yeah, they just got him to be an asset. No, like, they were starting him. Like, they thought that he was actually going to really help them. And I understand a little bit because they need more playmaking and they felt like he would provide that. But he's just, like, you know, the sixth best big on the team.
I don't know if we're ranking him ahead of or behind Tyler Zeller at this point.
We are ranking him behind Tyler Zeller, okay. in my humble opinion.
I mean, yeah, look, I think the main reason they got him, and yes, I think they saw him as a playable piece, but I think the main reason they got him was he's an large expiring salary that if something comes up where they could trade for a star or a potential star player, somebody who's already on a big contract, you know, you could use David Lee's deal to facilitate it. To trade him for a team that wants him, I think it's close to impossible, just because anybody who'd have to aggregate enough salary to match how much he makes, like, how do you do that without including at least one player who alone is more valuable than David Lee?
You make a great point there, and then also there's just not really anybody that he's going to help either. I mean, it was always just a coup for the Warriors to get them to take Lee without giving up anything at all in draft assets. And I think, you know, yeah, he's a big expiring salary. So is Gerald Wallace. I mean, you know, he's lead a little bit more, but still. So, all right. A couple other notes here. Jamari Carroll has returned to practice. He should be back soon after missing 9 games with a knee contusion. I've been impressed with how Toronto's been able to stay afloat without him.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they've had a number of injuries, and they've still looked good. Their potential is obviously higher, though, when he's healthy, and if they can get him ingrained with their other starters, like, that raises their ceiling to the point, you know, maybe they'd be the second-best team in the East, although maybe they're the second-best team in the East without him.
So then we have a trade. Philly continuing to follow the process, acquiring 2 second-rounders for a journeyman point guard to New Orleans. Oh, wait, what? It was the other way around? They picked up Ish Smith for 2 good second-rounders, the 2016 Denver and 2017 Philly picks? What is going on here?
Who's in charge there? This is a Jerry Colangelo, maybe Mike D'Antoni move written all over it. There's no way Sam Hinkie approved of this, wanted anything to do with this. This is just so far outside of everything he's done to operate this team. This is what it really comes down to for me from the 76ers' perspective. Ish Smith's going to be a free agent next summer. He's going to sign with whichever team makes him the best offer, however he sees the best offer, whether that's money, playing time, location, whatever's important to him. That's where he's going to sign. That might be Philadelphia. It might not. The odds have not changed because they traded for him. So you gave up 2 second rounders for somebody who can maybe help you improve from 1-30, but where does that get you?
It gets you out of setting the all-time loss record.
Does it?
I mean, this is just, it's so interesting to me that this is a franchise that completely ignored the optics for, you know, 2.5, 3 years, and now all of a sudden, just because, you know, what was it? Was it Jahlil Okafor got in a couple of fights? Was it, you know, we lost a couple of close games early? You know, I mean, granted, they were playing horribly, but, you know, now they're going to suddenly deviate, and not only deviate, but deviate this extremely. I mean, now, you know, right, yeah, 2 second round picks, it's not the end of the world, but this is one of the most mystifying trades to me in like the last 5 years, because Ish Smith is not good. They could have signed him as a free agent. They could have put in a waiver claim for him. The idea that you would give up 2 second round picks for 1 year of Ish Smith is just, it's a remarkably odd trade to me. But great job by the Pelicans doing that. You know, I mean, I wonder who made that first call. I mean, you have to imagine that it was Philly, and for them to just say, all right, we want 2 second round picks, and actually with a straight face, and then actually pull it up. I mean, you know what this is like? This is like one of those like Brooklyn Nets deals, right? Where it's like, all right, I understand why you want Smith. I understand why you want Paul Pierce and KG. But now it's like you didn't even negotiate at all, or you didn't try to find another alternative. I mean, how many other point guards out there who are as good as Ish Smith would have been available for less than this?
So I agree with everything you said, but I mean, in all likelihood, like, these picks aren't going to matter. Second round picks usually don't pan out.
I don't know. There's a big difference between a second round picks that are in like the top 7 or 8 of the second round and like 45. I mean, once you get beyond the 40s, I agree with you.
I think Denver's,
but those first few are pretty big.
I think Denver's like the 9th worst record right now. They could go in either direction. Philly should be somewhat better next year. You know, maybe to the point it's similar to where the Denver pick is. I don't think you should give up a positive asset for no good reason, and that's what they did, and that's troubling. What really gets me is, you know, is this just the first step? Like, the 76ers have already gone through all the pain and suffering of tanking at an extreme level that we've never seen before, and they've built up all these assets.
But where is this an extreme level that we've never seen before? They've had 2 years in a row in which they didn't have the worst record in the league. Now, this year, I mean, I guess this third year is starting to get pretty ridiculous.
Well,
but, you know, but it's all about the optics, right? The big problem that Sam had was just he never controlled the message well enough, and now it's like, oh, this is just the worst team in NBA history. Well, like, that's actually not quite true.
Well, it's the longest and most extreme we've seen a team choose not to get good. You know, other teams happen to be bad, and the teams that were worse than them the last couple years, it wasn't as if it were the same team. You know, Philly's the only team that's consistently near the bottom, and they did it by choice. We haven't seen that before.
Yeah, he's being penalized for, like, not pretending hard enough, essentially. And I, you know, it's his fault for doing that, right? Like, he should have just been more socially aware, had a higher emotional intelligence, done more interviews, got more of the local media on his side, all that kind of stuff. I mean, because it's all just, this is a very kind of emotional response to what's been going on. But I do think one thing is very clear, that, you know, this whole spiel about, oh, Sam is going to be making the final decision with input from Jerry. No, that's not true.
You know, I'm not completely convinced that's not true. I'm interested to see how it plays out. I think a lot of the talk from that was just supposing, well, Jerry Colangelo's always had control, but he hasn't always been 76 years old. He hasn't always taken jobs that came out of nowhere to him. You know, this wasn't on the radar to him.
But Sam would never do this, though. I don't think any GM who has been around for like the last 5 years and had an understanding of like what Ish Smith was would do this. Or to understand that you could, if you were going to really give up 2 second round picks and you wanted to improve as much as you could this year, you could do better than Ish Smith. Like all of those
Billy
things.
Billy King.
Yeah. So anyway, I think even Billy, you know, has kind of reformed a little
bit
to some degree. Anyway, I thought that was interesting. Last one, we'll be quick on this. The All-Star voting results, preliminary returns came out today. Kobe is in the lead at forward. One of sort of the dominoes down the road there, though, is that Anthony Davis is about 50,000 behind Blake Griffin for a starting front court spot. And if he does not get that, then the only way he can qualify for the Rose Rule, which will make him about $25 million more on his next contract, is to make an all-NBA team this year. So it's looking like, you know, unless the Pelicans really turn it around, it seems unlikely he'll get voted in as a starter.
And not only is he, you know, those 25,000 votes behind, he's in sixth. He'd have to jump Draymond Green and Kawhi Leonard and hope that neither one of them gets momentum either.
Yeah, that's true. And, I mean, this to me just shows everyone who is like, oh, yeah, you know, this is just a popularity contest for the fans. Who cares? Well, if that's really going to be true, then I think the next CBA needs to stop tying $25 million in a guy's pocket to these basically, you know, totally fun and unimportant returns.
Well, I've got 2 points to that. One, you know, maybe a player's value somewhat should be tied to how much fans like them and want to vote and support them. I mean, that's in a very, you know, far out sense, that's really what it comes down to. That's why the players make so much money, because fans want to pay money toward the league and their advertisers and all those things. So maybe popularity should count. One amendment I might make to the CBA is, look at Anthony Davis has already made one all-NBA team. He's already been voted an all-star starter once. Like, why do you have to meet the criteria like twice in each of the own categories? Why can't it just be two of those?
No, that makes sense. All right, let's talk some games here. Let's start with Chicago and Oklahoma City, which was kind of the game of the day other than Golden State. Cleveland, did you have some initial thoughts on this one?
Well, I think this was a big game for the Bulls after everything they've been through this week. Jimmy Butler calling out the coach. It seemed like this team was doing a lot of soul searching. Fred Hoiberg, I couldn't believe it. He called three practices this week for their three off days. I don't know how intense those practices are. You can hear three practices, and that sounds, you know, like fibs. Maybe it wasn't to that level. But just to have everybody come in, to not let anybody have a day off, like, that seemed extreme. And they came out and played with a lot of energy. They played hard. They played fast. They seemed to play more his way, and it gave them a big win, probably their biggest win of the year.
Yeah, it was impressive. And these games are the ones that give you hope for this Bulls team, because I think probably other than Cleveland, they have the best wins of any team in the East. Now, I don't think necessarily that there's really statistical evidence that like having good wins and bad losses means you have like kind of a higher upside in the playoffs, but because, you know, I don't think that you're like more or less consistent in the playoffs. I mean, think of that clunker they had in game six against Cleveland last year, but it does show that the potential is there for this team still, perhaps more than any other team in the East outside of Cleveland. What do you think of that?
Oh, that's an interesting point. I think they're right up there with the most potential. I might look at the Raptors, you know, who haven't been healthy, as being in that same tier. The Heat have older players, so I'm a little concerned about them, but if they all stay healthy, they might have that type of potential. But I'd have a hard case making that anybody outside of Cleveland has more potential in the East. I'm just not sure that the Bulls are on their own in that second tier.
Yeah, all right, that's fair enough. What do you think of Oklahoma City's effort in this game?
You know, what surprised me a little bit was there's been so much talk about how they stagger the minutes between Kevin Durant and Russell Westbrook. And, you know, they played a lot, the Thunder, that is, with one or the other both on the court, and they were fine when both played. They were even fine for the couple minutes that neither played. Where they really lost this game was where only one played, and it just seemed they weren't really comfortable playing that way, especially with Westbrook, the only one of the two stars on the court. Their offense fizzled, and he wasn't as aggressive. You know, if he's not going to be the guy when Durant sits, you might as well sit him too and let him get a few more minutes of rest.
Yeah, I thought Derrick Rose actually did a really nice job on Russ in this game.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I mean, Russ was trying to back him down. They actually work out together in the summer, and Rose was able to take a charge on him in transition like he knew it was coming. I think that actually probably helped Rose. And Rose, you know, still is strong enough, one of the few point guards in the league who's strong enough to avoid kind of that Russ back down. And then the Bulls defended the rim pretty well in this game. I mean, I thought the biggest problem for Oklahoma City was they just could not stop the Bulls inside. Steven Adams played very little, only 12 minutes and 45 seconds. He got into foul trouble early and then just didn't play well in his next stint in the third quarter. He only, I think, had one stint per half. And without him, then it was really trouble. Like, they tried to go small, but they didn't have Ibaka or Adams in there, and that was a disaster at the end of the third quarter. That was another kind of lineup from Donovan that didn't make a ton of sense. I mean, I like him going small, but at least leave one of those two guys in there so you can get some shot blocking. Mm-hmm. Gasol went wild as well. I mean, he was able to score on Cantor. Nick Collison guarded him one time, had no chance on him. So, you know, I think just another indication to me, because this is one of the worst offensive teams in the league they're playing against, that the Thunder defense is just not quite ready for prime time yet with some of the best teams.
Oh, I definitely agree with that. And the Bulls are not the team you want to experiment with small ball lineups that you don't have, you know, your best talent on the floor. Like, the Bulls are big, and they can just pound that down, and that's what we saw today.
Yeah, Bobby Portis was guarding Waiters for a lot of that time. He had a real nice game again, just his energy. I think when he's played enough minutes, it'll be interesting to look on Nylon Calculus and see, like, what percentage of offensive rebounds he chases, because I thought he was doing a really good job of going after that. Any other notes you had on this game?
Nothing else that really stood out.
Well, this may shock you, but I have a few.
All right.
But I would love to hear your comments on that. So, yeah, the Bulls, 25 of 38 in the restricted area. That is a ton of shots in the restricted area. And then Oklahoma City really got lucky that the Bulls were only 5 of 29 for mid-range. And the Bulls are one of the worst shooting teams in the restricted area. They shoot like 50%, so getting 65% was really good for them. Let's see, what else did I have? Yeah, it was just a ton of, like, little mistakes from Oklahoma City, whether it was, you know, they got within 8, and then KD just gives up a straight back cut to Butler to get it back to 10. You know, every time they started getting back close, they would always have some sort of mistake. It was KD missed a box out on Gasol. There are just a ton of little things that they just couldn't quite get over the hump, because they just, you know, you have to start playing perfectly when you're down 18 to start the fourth, and that's what happens.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if there was something going wrong with the Thunder, but I thought the Bulls looked very impassioned to start both halves, and I think that had to be a product of what happened with them this week. Like, yes, this is a Christmas game, and it's a big deal to some people, but it's still a regular season game. I don't think most teams come out with that type of energy, with that type of focus and determination. And I don't think the Thunder could match it. And maybe it's just because it was a regular season, but I'm sure they're asking themselves a little bit, like, is something wrong with our energy level? Like, are we not up to par?
Yeah, and the crowd was supposed to be awesome there too. What else did I have? What did you think of the starting lineup with Mirotić at the 3? This is now the second game in a row that they've run that out there.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan, and I'm guessing you're not either. He's just a little too big, a little too slow to be able to do that. It worked out okay in this game because Roberson isn't a huge threat, and you can stick him on Roberson. And
yeah, it might have actually helped because Mirotić is a little bit bigger than, like, Snow was, so he was able to kind of gum up the works, and Roberson didn't do anything. But, yeah, I mean, Mirotić, if he's playing the 3, all he's going to do is just shoot three-pointers, and that's it. And he's not shooting three-pointers that well. So, you know, it's just like, what is the point there? I mean, why not just start McDermott at that point if you're going to have Mirotić out there? And Mirotić, I think, only played the 3 and only played just those first two stints of each half, and he was 1 of 5, all of which were 3s. Although he was plus 20, I thought he did little to actually contribute. That's one of those times where plus minus is, like, pretty misleading.
Yeah, I mean, this was one of the rare times where we're saying, like, he has a good matchup there. That, you know, that's not usually going to be the case. I really don't like him staying in the starting lineup at 3 going forward.
Well, and it's just a waste of his skills. Like, I think they're really, you know, Portis is helping. Like, his three-pointer looks to be for real, which the Bulls really need, and his energy has been higher than Mirotić. I think, you know, in what little we've seen of him, he's played better than Mirotić. But I still think that to really reach its potential, this Bulls team needs Mirotić playing as a stretch four and, you know, at least being the player that he was last year.
So would you just let him play through it right now and you know, give Portis some minutes? Or how would you manage this in the short term?
Well, right now they have 4 bigs. with Noah being out. So you can get plenty of time for all of them. I mean, I think I would be starting Gibson. Gibson actually had one of his best games of the year in this one. 6 out of 8 from the field, 13 points, and real good defense as well. I think he needs to start alongside Gasol because the other two guys just aren't going to be good enough defensively, and that when Gasol's out there, it should be Gibson most of the time. And then maybe, I guess that Portis, Mirotić combo as the backups is a little rough, but, I'd be trying to get both of them some minutes. So I think there's enough of them right now because, Mirotić, the 3, is just, it's a waste of his talent. All right, let's move on to Miami and New Orleans. Not exactly a barn burner at noon Eastern time in Miami.
No, it sure wasn't. And as lethargic as they played on the court, I think the Pelicans stood out for being even mentally weaker. The big play to me was at the end of regulation. The Pelicans had the ball, tie game. They call a timeout. Alvin Gentry draws up a play. And watching on TV, their huddle didn't look right. Players looked confused. Didn't look like everybody was paying attention. But sometimes it just looks like that. Sometimes it's misleading on TV. They get out on the court, and Tyreke Evans is running the play on the wrong side. And so Alvin Gentry immediately calls another timeout and goes over it again.
It's a good timeout. Good timeout, though, by Alvin. Way to react.
And so, And that was not the only time the team just seemed out of sorts. I'm starting to wonder a little bit, maybe you have a little insight on this, having followed him with the Warriors last year. Okay, maybe he just has players who don't get it right now. Maybe he just has players who don't get it in general. Maybe it's all the players' fault. Or maybe Alvin Gentry, doesn't have quite the communication skills to be a really good head coach. Maybe he's better suited as an offensive-minded assistant.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that Alvin is renowned for as an assistant is being a great communicator, just in sort of more of an emotional sense necessarily than a strategic sense. And, he definitely was given credit for helping with the Warriors offense last year. How much of that is really true, it's hard to say. And I think also he and Darren Erman is known as a guy who is very cerebral and kind of nerdy, works his butt off, head down. But he and Alvin didn't really have a relationship before this. And so it may be that they, just haven't found their own kind of chemistry. And that Erman has not been in a position where he's had kind of this level of power and influence before. And maybe, he's someone that the players aren't listening to as much in that position. I don't know. That's pure speculation. That's just kind of what my theory is.
That makes some sense. Unfortunately for the Pelicans, this is quickly turning into if it's not already, and it probably is, but just a lost year as the coaches figure out how to make this work.
Yeah, it is. And part of that still is just that they don't have the personnel. Norris Cole was welcomed back to Miami with a big ovation from the stands. I'm not sure whether that was because to thank him for his efforts as a former Heatle, or because they knew that nobody on Miami was going to have to guard him for the entire game. and so they just helped off him so liberally. Mm-hmm. And that was really one of the big problems in the overtime was that Jrue Holiday, who finished regulation, had to go out because he's still on the minutes limit. He played 26:47, which is a little bit over his 25-minute limit, which is supposed to evaporate pretty soon. And so that's part of why they couldn't score at all in the overtime, because Dragic, who was guarding him, Wade was a little bit, those guys just camped out in the lane the whole time. And Cole had 10 shot attempts. He made 4 of them, but that also, and he was 0 for 2 on 3, so that really, he foiled any spacing that they would have wanted to have when he was out there. And then Alonzo G was another guy who was 0 for 2 in 17 minutes. You play Ashik a lot, too. Dante Cunningham barely played in this game. So you still really, the problem is you only have 5 good players on this team, and one of them is still on a minutes limit.
Speaking of minutes, 50 for Anthony Davis, and he definitely looked tired sometime in the second half, let alone into overtime. I mean, he played great, 29 points, 15 rebounds, 4 assists, 4 steals, 3 blocks, but a lot of those came in the first half, and it's just too much on him right now, and it showed in this game, and I think it's going to continue to show, and I just don't know where the Pelicans go from here. Do you keep playing Davis big minutes and you know, win as much as you can because that's where you are as a franchise, and wherever that lands you, do you scale it back and play for a higher draft pick a little bit, somewhere in the middle? You know, I think this is a team that really doesn't know where to go because they're so far off from where their expectations were.
Yeah, I think AD, I mean, like, they played him 22 and a half minutes in the first half. You know, I mean, he played the first 15 minutes of the game, and they were down. He had 11 of their 15 points in what was a putrid first quarter. And, you know, he played the same number of minutes in the second half as they were coming back. But I will say this, as anyone who's saying, you know, they're going to shut Anthony Davis down, well, it's $25 million for him to make a third team, at least third team All-NBA. So I would have to guess that he would not particularly be willing to acquiesce to that.
Well, I don't mean shut down, but just reduce his minute load a little bit.
Yeah, I wasn't saying that's what you're saying, sure. But I've heard that suggestion elsewhere.
Yeah, I mean, he could be more productive for the rest of the season playing fewer minutes per game.
What do you think of the fact that Hassan Whiteside basically never closes games for the Heat?
You know, I think they need to trust him more. He has defensive problems. He blocks a lot of shots, but they give up more points with him on the floor for a reason that's partially his fault. It's not all his fault. Some of that's coincidence. Some of that's how they stagger other players. But some of it's his fault. He chases blocks. And sometimes that leaves him vulnerable to giving up rebounds. Sometimes that leaves him vulnerable to giving up shots. But he's still a good defender. He can move his feet well, even if he doesn't know where to go. He gets lost more than he should. For his size, I'm not saying he's light on his feet, but for his size, he's reasonably light on his feet. I think a little more often, they need to give him an opportunity to grow and work through those situations.
That might be right. I think you have a decent argument there that, you know, playing Gerald Green over him down the stretch, that's not like the way to actualization of your team. You're not hitting your ceiling, which is really what this team needs to do. But on the other hand, you want him out there against an Anthony Davis, Ryan Anderson front court. Like, he's got nowhere to hide. Like, AD would just get jumper after jumper on him. You know, I mean, they like bring AD off of screens. He shoots threes. Like, there's no way that Whiteside can deal with that, especially once you get into that late game crucible where, you know, you're going to go to your best plays. You're going to attack the weak matchups. So I think certainly in this game, I would not have had him out there were I Eric Spoelstra.
Yeah, I agree with that. And beyond the strategic elements game to game and, you know, picking your moments of when to do it, I wonder if there's not a sense of, and I think it's too late, but I wonder if there's not a sense of, hey, he's going to be a free agent this summer. We don't want him getting the biggest contract he could get. We got a complicated situation with him and re-signing Dwayne Wade, you know. We're not going to necessarily give him a chance to show everything he can do this year. Once we lock him up next year, you know, he's still a young player, that's when we'll really go for broke with him.
This is a discussion I would like to get your opinion on. Do you think there's any reason why someone would want to trade for him this year, given what his contract situation was? We were talking about this in the media room before the Warriors game.
Well, the whatever team has him at the end of the season can offer him, it's going to be about $3-4 million more over a 4-year contract. Like, it's something.
And that's just the 7.5% annual raises for early bird over 4.5% if it's another team.
Right. And the other thing, you know, is maybe some team wants him as a rental on top of that. And just, you know, feels like he could really put them over the top for whatever their goal is this season. But between those, like, I think it's pretty minuscule. I don't think anybody's going to give up enough to make it worth the Heat's while. But the fact that the Heat are going to be right at the salary cap line if they don't make a move as far as giving Wade the max and Whiteside the max, and maybe one of those two guys takes a discount, maybe both do, maybe, you know, but it's going to be right around the line. You know, I could see the Heat thinking about it and looking and making sure that there's not that good offer from a team that feels that extra $3 million would put them over the top or wants him as a rental. So I do think it makes sense to look around, but I'd be really surprised if something makes sense for either side, let alone both.
Yeah, that makes sense to me too. And just if you're another team, I mean, what contender is going to trade him and give the Heat back a player who's actually going to help them more than Whiteside will this year? And any team, for those who don't understand this, any team that acquires him because he's only basically been on the Heat for 2 years, he's got early bird status. And so that means you can either pay him 175% of his previous salary, which is nothing, he's making the minimum now, or up to the estimated average player salary, which would be about $5.9 million to start, if you're going to exceed the cap. Otherwise, you know, he's going to make way more than that, obviously, no matter what happens the rest of this year. So that means that you have to use cap room to re-sign him, and you know, you don't have any kind of home court advantage other than just being able to offer him slightly higher raises on a contract. So that's why it kind of doesn't really make sense to give up an asset for him when you don't really have any kind of home court advantage to re-sign him in the way that, like, say, the Heat did with Goran Dragic when they acquired him last year.
The one thing that opens up a trade a little bit is the fact that almost every team is going to have cap space. So it opens up the possibilities of a team that could see Whiteside as helpful for this year and would have the room to re-sign him in the summer.
Yeah, a couple other observations on this game before we go. Justice Winslow continues to not get guarded at all. That's kind of a problem, you know, if you want to talk about having him in the closing lineup. That's why they had to play Gerald Green. Gerald Green is someone who's really going to get attacked defensively. I mean, when you think of Wade, Gerald Green, and then Luol Deng playing the four, so you have to have Deng guarding the big on the other team, which is Ryan Anderson in this case. Now, you've got Dragic, Green, and Wade is your perimeter defensive trio in down the stretch. Like, that's probably not something that's going to work for you. And Green, in fact, had a couple of instances of really bad defense on Eric Gordon, both in execution and just his ability to move laterally. So that was one issue. And then another one is just that AD's defense, I still have really been really unimpressed with that this year. I mean, especially, you know, because he was so exhausted too. It was tough in this game for him to both get out on Bosch and deter guys at the rim, because that really takes a lot of effort. And the Heat got quite a few layups in late in the game and in overtime because he was just sort of sticking to Bosch out in the perimeter. All right, anything else you had on this one? Should we move on to another one of these barn burners?
The one quick thing I'd add, Chris Bosch scored 30 points. I missed several shots early. The Pelicans were giving him space for his jumper, though, and I think it was just a real nice veteran game, somebody who understands what his skill set is, and Bosch kept shooting those until he started making them and making New Orleans pay, and that was really the difference in the game.
Yeah, and he not only that, he actually had a couple of nice drives mm-hmm. as well. In the overtime, I've always felt like Bosch, you know, should get a few more chances in isolation, especially when they're playing small. And what they were able to do was they had Deng, who was playing the four, would just screen for him. And, you know, really it was kind of a dummy screen. It wasn't really anything threatening. But New Orleans just switched that. And then it was Ryan Anderson one-on-one on Bosch. And New Orleans, of course, did a terrible job of helping, you know, when you've got, like, Wade just chilling on the weak side, three guys standing right next to each other. And Bosch was able to get two critical buckets in the overtime that way. All right, you ready for Houston, San Antonio?
Let's do it.
So my big takeaway from this is, like, Houston actually played hard, and lo and behold, they look pretty good.
I don't know if they look good. They look good enough. I mean,
I thought they looked really good. I mean, they beat, you know, an all-time great team.
Sure.
I do. The second in offensive efficiency held them to 84 points.
Sure. I mean, they played scrappy. They played hard, for sure. And that's why they won. I think that might even be more impressive, the fact that they weren't – I didn't think the Rockets looked particularly sharp on the whole. They picked it up definitely in the second half, especially James Harden. But on the whole, you know, I thought they were still a little, you know, too sloppy, not sharp on their shots. But the fact that they could still win and beat a team like this – you know, I don't know if it's too late for them to get this message, but they can realize, like, if we play hard, we're capable of doing some pretty good things. Like, it's not going to go for naught, that effort.
Yeah, I mean, it really just everyone on the Rockets, you know, there are many games before where it was palpable, you know, how bad their effort was. And they only gave up 11 fast break points. That's basically like the NBA average for a game. That's not too terrible. I thought that even like Ty Lawson had a good effort generally, though he got lucky with some miss when he let Patty Mills get a couple open threes that he didn't make. But generally, you know, had a nice sequence where he got over his pick and roll when he was guarding Danny Green. Just played overall with more energy. A couple of nice plays where they reversed the ball to him, and he basically kind of started his drive before he even caught it. And that was sort of the blueprint of how he was going to be effective on the team. He didn't start, didn't play that many minutes, but it's certainly, you know, one of his more encouraging games of the season. He was actually plus three and had 7 points on 5 shots, so hit a three. So I thought that was good. And then some of their other supporting guys had a good effort as well.
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely Harden and everybody else, but the fact that they could lean on so many players, especially Jason Terry, impressed me.
His defense was fantastic somehow in this game. Yeah.
I mean, when they traded for him, they got 2 second-round picks, and I thought they might cut him. And now, you know, what is it, 2 years later, and he's an integral role player on the team on both ends of the floor at this age. Like, I did not see that coming one bit.
He had 12 points on 5 shooting possessions. That's that's pretty good. And was plus 11 as well. With that bench unit in 17 minutes and also played some really good defense. He had a great steal when Danny Green tried to run a pick and roll. Danny Green is really struggling, isn't he?
Yeah. I mean, he was never a guy you want to put the ball in his hand, let him dribble around, but at least he could shoot, and he's not doing that. And, you know, he's on the floor, and I think he's getting a chance to work through his offensive problems because of his defense. I thought he was actually very impressive defensively today on James Harden, to the point I thought he defended Harden better than Leonard did. I thought Leonard had...
What makes you say that?
Well, I mean, just watching the individual possessions when they were matched up, Green did an excellent job of funneling Harden to help defenders and letting, you know, it's hard to keep Harden in front of you, but Green did a good job making sure he got to where the Spurs wanted him to go. I didn't think Leonard did that. I think Leonard probably had a stronger defensive game, but Leonard was at his best when he was guarding a lesser player, maybe Ariza or, you know, whoever else was on the court at the time, and could freelance a little bit, play the passing lanes. Like, he's an excellent on-ball defender, but Leonard's like, what sets him apart from the other excellent on-ball defenders is how good he is when he's freelancing. And so, you know, when you don't put him on Harden, you get a chance for him to do that a little more.
Yeah, Kawhi did have 5 steals and 3 blocks in this game. One time where Corey Brewer came down on the fast break and Leonard just basically enveloped him. He was waiting for him at the rim. That was a pretty awesome performance. But I see your point. I think that maybe you can argue that Green is a little bit better at getting over pick and roll screens than Leonard is. I mean, Leonard is obviously much better guarding kind of the more true wing guys who, you know, not necessarily shooting guards, but more small forward type of guys. And maybe you can also say that it's better to let Kawhi save his energy a little bit for offense. This is actually his first somewhat inefficient offensive game in a while. He had 20 points on 20 shooting possessions. That's a pretty good game for being an inefficient game, but still, you know, not quite to the level that we've seen from him lately. Tony Parker also kind of regressed a little bit, going only 1 of 7, and I thought Houston did a really nice job on him.
Do you think how Tony Parker has played before this game is sustainable? I mean, last year he looked washed up. I thought, you know, he was quietly near finished, and then this year he comes out and he's great all of a sudden.
You know, as I've confessed on the podcast, I haven't watched a ton of Spurs just because, like, their games always seem to be over by the time I turn to them. But in that Pacers game, I thought Parker was very impressive. He had some of the more athletic finishes that I've seen from him. I think, you know, he's getting to the age where he won't necessarily bring it every night. I mean, even last year, he had some real good games early in the season. Like, he killed the Warriors in that game when the Spurs beat them at home last year, or in November in Oracle. And he just kind of didn't have it by the time the playoffs came around. There's rumors that he was struggling again with his hamstring, but he does seem to at least have put that terrible Eurobasket performance behind him, as has Jerk, actually, who also didn't look particularly good at that time. So, I think anytime you're shooting like 57% on twos and you're a guard, you're probably going to regress a little bit. But I do think that he, you know, has been a positive force and that he can continue to be so. Although you wonder, once you get in against the really good teams, if, you know, he defensively is going to be a liability, because teams, especially the Rockets, did this a ton, did a lot of like 2-1 pick and rolls, or, you know, with whoever Parker was guarding, and you know, you obviously you can't switch that because he can't guard anyone like Harden one-on-one. So that there is, I mean, there are a lot of ways, despite the fact that this Spurs defense is really good, for good teams to attack this team, whether it's high pick and roll involving Duncan with a good shooter at point guard, or whether it's, you know, involving Parker in basically any kind of action, or if Parker's off the ball, you can go post him up. You know, there are ways to attack them if you have the personnel.
Yeah, and, you know, I think you mentioned that the Rockets, as much success as they had with those 2-1 pick and rolls, they're not used to running them, and so they could be a little clunky at times. You get.
Are you saying Corey Brewer isn't like a polished roll man?
I don't want to besmirch him, but yes. And so you get to a playoff series, and a team gets a chance to, you know, to make those part of their game plan. You can work on them in a shoot around and a practice, and you know, that could be pretty dangerous.
A few other notes I had. One was that Ariza was fantastic in this game guarding Kawhi, and there's one sequence that just, you know, almost had me out of my chair where Tim Duncan had the ball at the elbow. Ariza denied Leonard popping out to get the ball. Leonard tried to go backdoor again. He denied him again, and then he tried to pop out again. Duncan threw the pass, and Ariza stole it. Like, it was just a fantastic effort over, like, you know, a 10-second period denying the ball. And he did a lot of that, and they prevented Kawhi from getting to his spots as easily and you know, made everything hard for him. Ariza was key. And then I also, you know, another aspect of the Spurs that I feel like is something that can be attacked is that bench big lineup with Diaw and West with more athletic teams like Houston.
Yeah, but those two have been so good offensively and keeping the ball moving. Like, when you have bigs who can move the ball like that, you have to keep up, you know, on the other end against them defensively. Like, it's not, I don't see it as so much as an area to exploit the Spurs as much as an opportunity to keep up with them.
Yeah, I think that's right. And it also just depends on the personnel as well. I thought, you know, Terrence Jones was able to have a real nice performance. He was 6 out of 11 in 22 minutes, mostly getting to the basket. And, you know, that was, he was being guarded by Dia, he was being guarded by West, and those guys can't really keep up with him on the boards or rolling to the rim. So that, I thought that was a little bit of a struggle. I mean, you don't have anyone, neither of those guys can block a shot. You know, I don't think either of them are really great defensive rebounders. And, you know, you can say in the playoffs we're not going to see as much of those two guys together. You know, that's kind of more of a regular season thing, and they know how to play, so you're not going to get killed against most teams, as you alluded to. So maybe that's not something that'll be a problem in the playoffs for the Spurs.
I mean, tonight, yeah, Jones definitely had a nice game, but on the flip side, you can't really play him against Aldridge or Duncan because he can't guard either one of them in the post. So I guess credit the Rockets for really getting Jones in the game at the right spots.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, Jones probably still has nightmares about LaMarcus lighting him up from that series against Portland 2 years ago. And he just, you know, for whatever reason, I mean, some guys just can't get the rhythm of post defense. They don't know how to use their body. They jump at the wrong time. They can't contest. They just kind of don't have the core strength. Whatever it is, he is, for his athleticism, an atrocious post defender. And, you know, basically any time LaMarcus was on him, when Duncan was on him, he just has no shot. And it's kind of a problem against teams with good power forwards for Houston.
The crazy thing is, I think he's made significant strides since that series against Portland. And I agree with you about where he is right now completely.
This is another little foible that kind of annoyed me. And, you know, Ethan and I already talked about the intentional fouling, but in this game, Pop, they were down, I think, 70 to 60. Manu hits a three. They're coming back. They've only given up 2 points, and it's 72-69. And so Pop decides that he's going to get cute, and they're going to foul Dwight Howard before the inbound has occurred, which is a two-shot foul, even though they weren't in the bonus. And they screw that up. And then there's another time where they fouled under 2 minutes and ended up giving Harden a free throw, which he missed. And I was just thinking, like, they've scored 2 points in the last, you know, 5 minutes of the game. Why are you going to the intentional fouling strategy? You have one of the best defenses of all time out there.
Yeah, and on top of that, the Rockets have been, maybe not in this game, maybe they saw something in this game where the Rockets were just a different team, but throughout the season they've had problems with transition defense, and so you give up any chance of getting into transition. I'm with you, I was a little curious to make that the moment you go to it. That even though wasn't the Spurs foul decision that bothered me most, it was when the second to last possession, I want to say like
37-ish. Oh yeah, they're up four and there was a 13 second differential and Houston had the ball and they didn't foul.
Right. I mean, you know, what are you going to do down four in 13 seconds? You know, even if you get the stop, like your odds are so much lower than, you know, extend the game.
Yeah. I mean, and you know, fine, you foul. The odds are they're at least going to hit one out of two. I mean, it's a bad situation either way, but, and what ended up happening, of course, was they took like 7 seconds to even get a three-pointer. They never even got a second possession out of it, and it took forever to even get that first shot off. So, and you don't have any chance of, you know, pressuring up to get a steal later. I mean, that's how a lot of these comebacks happen when you're down that much. You know, that's how the Clippers came back in the Thunder the other night, was they actually got a steal in the backcourt. Like, that's what you're relying on probably more times than you think you are. So, yeah, I didn't like that. And, you know, really, the Spurs were never able to get back in contact that well, even though Capella missed those free throws. I think Dwight missed a couple as well when they intentionally fouled him. You know, so the theory worked that way. But nonetheless, you know, they didn't make the comeback. So it's more the process than the result I had a problem with. But it's just Pop didn't learn his lesson. Like, he probably cost them game two. I forget which game it was against the Clippers last year, where they were up by like eight or ten in the second quarter. He started fouling, and then the Clippers came back. So he didn't learn his lesson there, and he likes to just keep doing it. I don't get it.
One of the funnier situations was when they couldn't get it off in time. The intentional foul and so they ended up fouling with like a minute 59 left. So Harden gets free throw on the ball. Like, you know, these silly things happen when you do that.
It's just trying to be too cute. Like, it kills me. All right, let's do a little bit on Clippers-Lakers. I will confess that I kind of stopped watching this one at halftime. The Lakers eventually came back in garbage time, forcing the Clippers to reinsert their starters, but they eventually won. The Clippers won comfortably by about 10 or so. You probably watched more of this game than I did. What did you think of this game? I mean, to me, it's just amazing that the Lakers are just never competitive when they play against good teams.
Well, I'm going to make one point about the comeback. It was largely reserves against reserves. The Clippers had to bring their starters back in, but you know, the Lakers started to do it on the backs of their reserves against the Clippers reserves. And, you know, you make a few stops, you hit a few shots, your confidence gets up, you start to play a little harder, the crowd, who's ever left, gets a little excited, and all that happened. But here's the one thing that I think really contributed to it. The Lakers just started hacking the Clippers. Like, any little chance they had, they put their hands on them. I mean, it looked like a 1990s game. They were being so physical. And I really think the refs swallowed their whistle because they wanted to go home. You know, the game was decided. Like, calling these fouls wasn't going to change who won or lost. Like, it was late enough in the game, and the Lakers' comeback hadn't been dramatic enough by the time they really started getting handsy. But that's what helped them come back even further to make it to the point where, like, it's a notable comeback instead of something we can ignore completely.
All right, yeah, that's an interesting point. And, I mean, I definitely think that there is a little bit more kind of manipulation of calls by the refs than we've seen in the past. Like, I remember there are just a lot more late whistles to me than there used to be. Like, the ones where it's like, I'll give it to you if you need it. Yeah, I remember I was playing in this rec league game once, and you know, I just got killed, and I made the shot anyway. The guy didn't call the foul, and he's like, "Oh, I'll give it to you. Need it if you need it." And I'm like, you know, part of the reason, but you know, I think they just they want to kind of speed things up, and that's fine. Like, I think the game is probably better overall for it, but it is a little maddening when you're kind of picking and choosing like that, and only calling the foul if the guy misses. Paul Pierce, 1 out of 6 in this game. Are you worried that he just is not going to be effective for this Clippers team at all, ever?
Name somebody who comes off their bench, and I have that exact worry about them. Like, every single one of them has had spurts where they look awful, and none of them have had spurts where they look really good.
Pierce, to me, the way that they are using him, and now this could just be he's old, they don't want to play him too much, but the way that they are using him does not make a ton of sense to me, because at this point in his career, he's going to be a spot-up guy who's going to kind of hit big shots.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and maybe play the four a little bit like he did in the playoffs last year for Washington, which, you know, he's never going to play the four down the stretch for this team. But if you're not going to have him on the floor with all the good guys, playing him as a backup stretch four with a bunch of guys who can't pass at all is not a recipe for him to do well. Now, he's not hitting any of his shots. He's shooting like 27% on three, and he's not taking a ton of bad shots either. So that's a concern. But when you're playing with Rivers, Crawford, Stevenson is the best passer among those guys on the second unit. Josh Smith, another guy who you know, doesn't provide much spacing, takes some questionable shots, although he's been out of the rotation these last couple games in favor of Cole Aldrich. You know, I'm not really sure how it is that Pierce is expected to succeed playing with those guys.
I guess my counter is, okay, if he's your guy to hit big shots, there are no big shots at this time of year. So maybe the best bet is just to keep his minutes down, and you can manage that a little easier if he's coming off the bench. Whatever, you're keeping him loose, you're still winning, you know, enough games. Like, the Clippers look destined, you know, there are a few teams ahead of them that I don't think they can pass. There are a few teams behind them that I think are possible to pass them, but it's unlikely. Like, they look destined to be the four seed. You know, just play them in this role for now and then adjust it late in the season for the playoffs.
Oh, yeah. One thing I will say, too, you may not have listened to this podcast, but Danny and I gave our record scratch All-Stars the other day, and we lamented we couldn't find a power forward. Larry Nance, you are my power forward on the record scratch All-Stars. He had some pretty remarkable ones playing with that first unit for the Lakers, where he'll just like catch the ball on the baseline and do absolutely nothing with it time after time.
And the highlight tonight where he tips the ball from a nice distance into his own basket.
From like the free throw line. He's probably made like three shots from longer than that distance all season. All right, man. Anything to plug before we go?
You know, we talked a lot about Hassan Whiteside. Just wrote something a little more in depth on him. You can find that at Pro Basketball Talk, NBCSports.com.
All right, and Dan's a great guy to follow too. Whenever there's sort of some cap implications of a move or a trade, like he's always, you know, doing a lot of newsers, but he'll always add good stuff on the cap implications. One of the best cap guys out there, and one of the reasons we enjoy having him on. Of course, so it's definitely good to check out his stuff there, just, you know, whenever there's a trade or some thoughts on that kind of stuff. As for me, you can follow me on Twitter at NateDuncanNBA. Dan, your Twitter handle?
DanFeldmanNBA.
All right. Yeah, and Dan needs more followers, too, by the way, because it was really a shame because you used to be Piston Powered, and that's got, like, you know, a ton of followers, and then you had to kind of give that up, and now someone else is running Piston Powered. And you had to start your own. So Dan needs more followers. Definitely follow him. It's a good account. All right, that'll do it for us today. Thanks for coming on, Dan, and we will talk to you all next time.
Thanks for having me.